Debbie Heath is back with me once again to discuss another book. This time she suggested a book that's called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Hanneman. Very successful. It's been translated into umpteen languages, or huge success. Made a lot of money for a first book, in fact. Mm. The title amuses me in a sense that it's a very precise title, because Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. There's about 15 other ways of saying the same thing. He's absolutely all right. He's okay. He's whatever. But why? I mean, it's finessed, isn't it, that title?
Yes, it's very characteristic of Eleanor that she doesn't like to engage in conversation. And if someone asked how she was, she would just say, fine, and that would be it. She wouldn't have to say anything else.
Because it closes down the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely closes it down. And she comes back to the word fine a lot within the novel. It's a catchy title. It's slightly interesting. Her surname's unusual. I first came across this book when it was serialised on Radio 4. When I heard it, I was hooked, actually. I thought it was very, very funny, also very, very sad, and latterly very, very clever.
It took me a while to get into it when I read it at first, and I've listened to it as well as read it. And reading it, at first, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 pages, I thought, am I going to stick with this? I don't know what it was. I didn't engage with her, and gradually she became totally engrossing. I couldn't avoid her, because she is the narrator. She's the voice of the whole book.
I found, like you, it took a while, but I say a while, it was within the first episode. Probably by about the 10th minute, I was hooked. And it's very little things that engage me. For instance, she's talking about leaving the office and she wants to do it quickly. And she puts her hands in her gloves, which she has on a string, like you do for children, inside her coat so that she can react very quickly when the weather changes. And I thought, oh, it's a bit quirky. And she talks also very early on about going to an office mate's wedding reception. And she was very cross because they had to pay for their own drinks. And the only thing that was free were the cheese pasties. But it was all right because she just slipped some of them into her shopper. And I thought, wow, someone takes a shopping bag to a wedding. Now, this is an interesting person. And it was just little things like that, just a little blasé mention of something that you and I would find peculiar, that just gave it a sense of charm from the outset, I would say.
Yes, I think some people wouldn't see it as charming because they would see it as, here's a person struggling with life in many, many different ways. It's very strange and it takes you time to work out what's going on and you dip in and out of various situations. But her relationships with people are, to say the least, odd.
She is odd. She is struggling. We see that because we've read the whole book. But I think she's also managing her life. She has found ways of giving it structure. So she feels happier in a way during the week in the boring office environment, and she gets stressed at the weekend where she gets through two bottles of vodka.
On Fridays, I don't get the bus straight after work, but instead I go to the Tesco Metro around the corner from the office and buy a margarita pizza, some Chianti, and two big bottles of Glen's vodka. When I get home, I eat the pizza and drink the wine. I have some vodka afterwards. I don't need much on a Friday, just a few big swigs. I usually wake up on the sofa around 3 a.m. and I stumble off to bed. I drink the rest of the vodka over the weekend, spread it throughout both days so that I'm neither drunk nor sober. Monday takes a long time to come around.
Of course she's struggling, but I don't think she realises she's struggling. She just thinks she's completely fine.
The reason the weekend is such a struggle is that she is on her own.
Yeah.
She doesn't see anybody from when she gets home on the Friday, having been to the shop en route and got herself the meal for that evening and the couple of bottles of vodka and whatever else. She gets to the weekend and then we're back to Monday again. Now, the whole book begins with a description of where she works. In a sense, she puts herself down. In a sense, she puts us down. It's quite a clever play on words, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
When people ask me what I do, taxi drivers, dental hygienists, I tell them I work in an office. In almost 9 years, no one's ever asked what kind of office or what sort of job I do there. I can't decide whether that's because I fit perfectly with their idea of what an office worker looks like, or whether people hear the phrase work in an office and automatically fill in the blanks themselves. Lady doing photocopying, man tapping at a keyboard. I'm not complaining. I'm delighted that I don't have to get into the fascinating intricacies of accounts receivable with them.
She doesn't think very much of her colleagues. There's the chatty one who always brings a conversation back to her. One little thing I love is how she brings in her own teapot and teacup because she doesn't like the idea of using one that has been poorly washed by another cohabitee. Just as any working environment, there are always people you get on with and people you don't. And possibly at the beginning you think, oh no, this isn't just going to be a boring office book. And of course it's not. And if it wasn't for the office, we wouldn't have the story. Because very early on, I think it's the second chapter where she says her monotonous life has changed because she's basically fallen in love with a singer she met on an office outing. So that office is a really important dynamic, even though the story itself doesn't happen there.
She's in fantasy land that time because he doesn't even know she exists.
Exactly. So it is a rather strange one. In a way, it's like a 10-year-old falling in love with someone on the television. So in many ways, she's very immature, and that clashes with her very mature comments about her observations about other people. So we think, this is an interesting character. She has these little quirky behaviours. She's not quite grown up. There's some arrested development there. She's probably had some issues in her childhood. I wonder what they are. And very soon, we get to realise that Eleanor had a very strange upbringing. And we work this out because she has regular conversations with her mother every Wednesday.
It was Wednesday evening. Mummy time. However much I might wish it were otherwise, she always managed to get through to me in the end. I sighed and turned off the radio, knowing I would have to wait until Sunday's omnibus now to find out whether Eddie Grundy's cider had fermented successfully. I felt a flash of desperate optimism. What if I didn't have to talk to her? What if I could talk to someone else, anyone else? Hello, I said.
Oh, hiya, Hen, it's just me. Some weather the day, eh?
And the mother is continually putting Eleanor down. And there we see why she started to behave as she did. She has very low self-esteem, not just because of the way her mother speaks to her, but because also we learn early on she has a horrific scar across her face. This brings me on to another interesting point. I think this book is about misconceptions, about how you make a judgment about someone based on what they look like or how they behave without really understanding why that is and what they might be inside. So obviously, the first way in is think of it in terms of Eleanor, that she looks a bit strange. So other people think that she is strange. But if we turn this round a bit, we've also got to realise that Eleanor is very quick to judge other people in a positive way. She's decided this poor pop star is her ideal man. He has no idea. And this is all based on the fact that he left the bottom button of his waistcoat undone. She also has a very low opinion of the work computer guy, Raymond.
When I returned to the office, my computer still wasn't working. I sat down gingerly and called Raymond in IT again, but it went straight to his preposterous message. I decided to go upstairs and find him. From his voicemail greeting, he sounded like the kind of person who would ignore a ringing telephone and sit around doing nothing. Just as I pushed my chair back, a man approached my desk. He was barely taller than me and was wearing green training shoes, ill-fitting denim trousers, and a T-shirt showing a cartoon dog lying on top of its kennel. It was stretched taut against a burgeoning belly. He had pale, sandy hair cut short in an attempt to hide the fact that it was thinning and receding, and patchy blonde stubble. All of his visible skin, both face and body, was very pink. A word sprang to mind. Porcine.
As time goes on and they both share a very strange experience, she comes to realise that he's actually a nice chap and a possible friend for her.
And that experience is early enough in the book for us to talk about it. It's not going to
ruin
the plot.
Oh, yeah, it won't ruin anything.
It's something that happens when they both happen to be in the same place on the street and somebody, an older gentleman falls over.
Yes.
And she hears the thud of his head as it hits the pavement, I think.
Yes. She doesn't really know how to help, so she decides to talk to him about the redness of his jumper. But in any case, he's hospitalised, and Raymond encourages Eleanor to visit Sammy, this is the old man, with him in the hospital. Eventually he gets better and goes home. This opens up more friendship groups or acquaintances, really, to Eleanor because she gets to meet Sammy's family. And this is the event, really, that sparks off her personal journey within the book.
Because she's actually engaged with somebody
else? She's engaged with other people, and that's really important. And she's made judgments about people, and very quickly she realises they're wrong.
We might be giving the impression that this woman is actually a bit of a pain. She judges other people very quickly on how she sees them. She's isolated, lonely. Why should we bother reading the book? But actually the book, the audiobook, whichever way you come at it, it trundles along at a fairly fast pace. And that's because of the writing, which is very quite efficient, isn't it?
It's very efficient. It's very funny, but it's quickly funny. You've got comedy scenes like when Eleanor goes to the body waxing parlour. That's absolutely hilarious. And hearing that on the radio really grabs your attention. So, yeah, that's quite funny. But I think that Gail Honeyman uses language very deftly. It's a very light touch and she moves on quickly. It's just peppered with little bits of humour. Eleanor is strange, but it's through these little canny observations that you just kind of fall in love with her, really, don't you? When I finished reading the book, I felt, oh, I've lost a bit of a friend there. I wasn't quite ready. And I think I'm going to treat this as a going to sleep book. You know, sometimes you have those nights where you can't drop off and I put on an audio book. And it's something that is comforting. There aren't many books like that for me, I have to say.
I read somebody who had said that actually they hated this book because they felt that the main character was just being used by the author as somebody to set up in order to knock down. It was a character that we could ridicule. The jokes were really on her. In other words, the character was there to be laughed at.
Yes, I mean, some of the things she does are funny, things like her shopping bag. But I don't feel I'm laughing at her. I think it's a fondness, like your child might do something funny and you just chuckle about it. You're not ridiculing someone. It's a fond humour. But no, I don't feel we're laughing at her. I think people in her office might be laughing at her, but we have reason to believe that they're a bunch of idiots as well. That's a preconception, isn't it? But the point is, I don't think we laugh at her. I think some other people do, and we realise that that's unsubstantiated, really.
How soon do we start to feel that there's something more here that we don't know a great deal about? There's some sort of event, or there's some sort of trauma, or there's some sort of... Does that come through fairly quickly?
There is a bit of a twist at the end of the book, which I had anticipated probably about halfway through. But I think we realise that things are a little bit deeper about a quarter of the way through the book. Is there something that sparks that off? I'm not sure.
Is it just our experience of the world as we now know it? It's quite a complicated world and we see people with different sorts of conditions and we say, well, here's somebody who can't relate, who can't make relationships, struggles to do it. It's only through some sort of an accidental event that she begins to soften a little towards other people, doesn't prejudge quite so much, but then she's back to doing that for the rest of her relationships. She has this IT guy that he is very gentle and very kind to her. She finds that quite difficult to cope with. She can't reciprocate very easily. So we begin to build up a picture that here is somebody we might even in our minds start to identify the one or two different sort of conditions.
Well, I think she's got this social worker who comes very early on in the book because she talks then about how before that point, no one else had visited her that year. Very sad. And this social worker is new to Eleanor's case, which annoys her to start with because she feels she has to start all over again. And the social worker looks at her file and says, goodness, I have no idea. And then she notices that Eleanor has said she doesn't want to know anything about her past. And that, I suppose, is the clue that something very bad has happened. Otherwise, why would she be blocking it out? And so during the book, particularly towards the end, she develops enough inner strength to come to terms with what has happened in her life to make her who she is. And it's only by doing that that she can move on.
Go back to the beginning of what you said, of course, that there she is. She's worked 5 days a week in the office and then goes home for 2 days of nothingness, apart from vodka.
And talking to her pot plant as well. Is it Polly?
Yes,
Polly, that's a very important person.
So we're talking here about loneliness.
Yeah.
And we haven't actually used that term much in our discussion today, but actually here is somebody who is very lonely. We're watching that process going on, a loneliness being attacked a little and then she retreats from it. Loneliness is a common issue today.
It is. And there was a lovely quote, wasn't there? Loneliness is the new cancer, and neither you or I could find it in the book, but we know it's there. The book opens with a quote about loneliness from another writer. I think loneliness is a real problem now. I mean, the internet is marvellous. It enables us to do a lot of things, but I think it also prevents us from doing a lot of things. And some teenagers now who might find it hard to relate to human beings can retreat into online relationships, which to me seems like a loneliness issue, but to them they're not lonely because they just talk to people in different ways. Suicide rates are on the increase, particularly among teenagers and even older children. And I suppose a lot of this is, they're saying at the moment, due to social networking sites, aren't they? But I think really a lot of this is about loneliness because teenagers and young people are feeling that they have to manage problems themselves, that they don't have anyone they can turn to. They don't feel they have the support networks.
And this book doesn't make it any worse because you could argue that it actually explores loneliness in different ways. You were talking about IT, you talked about the social networks. She does actually buy some technology as the story goes on because yes. She wants to be able to access other sources.
Well, she buys that computer because she wants to do some research, as she calls it. I think her mother calls it stalking. She wants to find out about Johnny Lomond, this pop star she's fallen in love with. But I think eventually she will be able to use a computer for the greater good. And it is, yes, I suppose, getting her to look outwards a little bit more.
We've heard a few extracts from this book, and that perhaps it helps us to lift the tone because we don't want to give the impression that it's a very sad book, but it actually isn't. It's actually quite an intriguing book. I think I was sad at the beginning.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, this is tough, but then
it's
the humour...
It's uplifting, isn't it? Yeah.
The humour, the way in which she directs us to think about different things, about different people, about different situations, is in fact something that drags you on through, which is rather nice, and I enjoyed it very much.
I think another interesting theme is that of reinvention, that she realises, oh well, it's because she fancies this pop star, that she wants to make herself more attractive. And I think we all go through a period of that in our lives. I decided I needed to take control of my colour scheme and my makeup and things like this. It's all gone wrong now. But we all feel we have to reinvent ourselves. And I found that really quite funny at times, where she got her makeup done and said she looked like a... Well, it wasn't a panda, but it was something very, very funny. It does smack of a teenager discovering things for the first time. But here's an interesting question for you, because you've read the book and you've listened to it. What do you think is the best format?
Best medium.
Yeah.
I'm so used to reading books. I'm so used to the control that gives me. I find it... I listen to audiobooks in the car and various other places. I find it very difficult to find the time to listen to an audiobook in the rest of my life. That's the problem,
whereas
I can grab a book.
It is hard.
But audiobooks are increasingly well used and popular. There's a huge demand for audiobooks now.
And it's not just people like me who can't see properly. A lot of people go running and listening to an audiobook. I believe this has been very popular with book groups. A lot of my friends have read it, and some of those have chosen to listen to it. The downside for someone like me is that it takes away my own interpretation of a book. You know, it's someone else's. But I think it was really well read. I can't remember who did read it. I think she did a really good job. Lovely, precise voice. She characterised the others very well too, not just Eleanor. So I think it's a good audiobook. I did like the adaptation on Radio 4, which I dare say will be repeated at some point. It was abridged, but it did work well. And I would imagine you probably got through that book pretty quickly, didn't you? You could read it over a weekend, I expect.
Oh, yes.
That's not to take away from the depth of the book, because there's a lot going on.
Because it moves fast. There isn't a lot of weighted language. There's not loads and loads of adjectives. And it just gets on with it and it rolls through because she's like that. It is her.
Yes. I'm a book snob, as I've mentioned before. But I was pleasantly surprised. I really liked it, and I would recommend that people give it a try.
My thanks to Debbie. Also to Caliber Audio. It's a charity which provides audiobooks free of charge to those who, for reasons of sight loss or some other medical or physical condition, are not able to handle the printed version. Caliber has allowed us to use those extracts from this recording by Kathleen McCarran, which, by the way, is approximately 11 hours long from start to finish.